speakers suddenly drowned out the sound of laughter. Schreur's music turned to static, and he pulled the headphones from his ears. "The British must have heard their show," he announced to the crowd. They were jamming his transmissions. The mood grew somber. The men remembered what the games, costumes, food, and drink had tried to make them forget. That they were still at war. 3 weeks later, early May 1942. In the darkness, Franz stumbled over tent ropes and pegs as he ventured down a small hill into the wadi where Squadron 3 had pitched their tents. He spotted a tent, larger than the others, that served as the pilot's bar and casino. Schreur had told Franz to drop by the bar that night, and he would introduce him to Marseille. If the introduction went well, Franz planned to ask Marseille for an autograph. The Squadron 3 bar itself was a tribute to Marseille, bearing a sign just above the doorway that read, "The Star of Libya." The sign had been put there during the filming of a newsreel about Marseille, and no one wanted to take it down. As Franz entered the tent, the rhythm of rumba music blasted from a phonograph, even though such Americano music had been banned in Germany. Oriental rugs lined the floor. On the walls hung pictures of actresses and models who had written to Marseille. Franz had heard rumors that Marseille had slept with all of them. Schreur was there already, watching two men play chess. He spotted Franz and signaled him over. One of the chess players was Marseille, the thin, dashing Bohemian Berliner. He looked the way his French ancestry suggested he would, with an angular face, arching eyebrows, a sharp nose, and thin lips. He was young, just 22, and wore his long hair swept back over his ears. Had it not been slicked back, it would never pass regulations. He wore the Knight's Cross around his neck. The other player was a young African man with short, fuzzy hair who wore the same tan shirt and shorts as Marseille, but without shoulder boards of rank. He was the former Corporal Matthew Letuku, known to the squadron as Matthias. Franz had heard of him. Matthias had fought for the South African army before the Germans had captured him the prior summer. Somehow, Matthias had wound up re-employed by Squadron 3 as a driver and bartender for squadron parties. A far better fate for him than languishing in a POW camp. During duty hours, Matthias doubled as a sort of batman or butler for Marseille, doing odd jobs such as cooking and laundry. In off hours, Matthias and Marseille socialized and played chess. Matthias helped Marseille improve his English, and Marseille taught German to Matthias. In the process, they had become best friends. In Germany, this would have violated laws meant to keep races apart. But in the desert, Marseille and the pilots of JG-27 accepted Matthias as more than a prisoner. He was their friend.
"Franz, pull up a chair,"
Schreur said. Marseille and Matthias pushed their game aside. Schreur introduced Franz to Marseille, who sat in a wooden armchair made from shipping crates, a gift from the supply men. Marseille and Schreur had been roommates in flight school and wingmen over the channel. Marseille had a bottle of French cognac on a nearby table and called for an orderly to bring a snifter glass for Franz. Matthias excused himself to let the pilots talk. Franz was surprised that Marseille was quietly charismatic and gracious, far from his boisterous reputation.
"Franz is new to the unit," Schreur said.
"Have you scored a victory yet?"
Marseille asked.
"Not yet," Franz said, embarrassed. Everyone knew it was JG-27's policy to try to get a new pilot his first victory within 10 missions. But for Franz, 10 had come and gone.
"There's no reason to apologize for never having killed a man,"
Marseille said. He poured Franz a tall glass of cognac.
"As soldiers, we must kill or be killed. But once a person enjoys killing, he is lost. After my first victory, I felt terrible."
Marseille wrote a letter to his mother the night of his first victory that read,
"I keep thinking how the mother of this young man must feel when she gets the news of her son's death. And I am to blame for this death. I am sad instead of being happy about the first victory."
an empty cognac bottle later, Marseille and Schwerer shared their secrets of combat and survival with Franz, who leaned in close, his eyes lazy from too many drinks.
"Shoot from as close as possible, 75 yards or less," they told him. "Drink lots of milk. It's good for your eyes. Stare at the sun a few minutes per day to build your tolerance. Strengthen your legs and abdominal muscles so you can take more G's."
Franz nodded, forming a foggy mental checklist. Franz wanted to ask Marseille if all the stories he had heard were true, if Marseille had a flat where he entertained an Italian general's wife, if he had slept with a field marshal's daughter, and if he dated an American lady who worked as a newspaper reporter. But, although those tales of philandering interested Franz, one question burned hotter in his mind.
"Is it true you flew over a British airfield and dropped notes to them?"
Franz asked. Marseille knew what Franz was getting at, but he just shrugged with a guilty, thin grin. Franz had read and heard the story, but never had it corroborated. The legend went that Marseille had shot down a British pilot named Byers, who had been badly burned when captured. Marseille personally took Byers to the field hospital, where hospital staff told Marseille the prisoner's name and unit. That evening, Marseille flew through British flak to drop a note over Byers' airfield, addressed to his comrades. The note said that Byers was badly wounded, but was being cared for. 2 weeks later, when Byers died of his wounds, Marseille felt so badly that he flew back through the flak to the British field and dropped another note, notifying Byers' friends and sending deepest regrets. It was a gallant act that earned the respect of many in the Air Force, except for one, the second most powerful man in the party, who doubled as the Air Force's leader, Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. Göring had once been an ace in the Red Baron squadron in World War I, but had since become known throughout the Air Force with disdain. Someone had nicknamed Göring the Fat One, due to his heft, and it had stuck. Göring put out an edict that no pilot should ever again attempt a stunt like the one Marseille had.
"Is the story true?"
Franz said to Marseille. Schwerer nodded slightly, for only Franz to see.
"We only need to answer to God and our comrades," Marseille said.
To Franz, this sounded like something Father Joseph had told him years prior. Curious, Franz asked if Marseille was a man of faith. Marseille revealed that he was a Catholic too. As their conversation grew in depth, Franz realized that he was drunk, more drunk than he had ever been. He was not accustomed to liquor, having been raised on Bavarian beer, and had never tried cognac before that night. Franz stood, wobbly, to excuse himself. He thanked Marseille and Schwerer for their hospitality and tried to salute, but swiped his hand at the wrong angle. Marseille saluted back just as sloppily, with a grin. Marseille's salute was known for always being that bad, sober or drunk. Stumbling into the darkness as the breeze kicked up the sand, Franz realized he had forgotten to ask for an autograph. Several nights later, Fergal grew tired of hearing Franz talk in the squadron bar about his meeting with Marseille.
"I want to show you something,"
Fergal told Franz, and pulled him outside. Franz did not feel like a walk in the blowing sand, but he followed his superior. Strolling by the silent rows of parked planes, they stopped at Marseille's Yellow 14. Nearby, crewmen worked on another plane's engine by floodlights covered with heavy tarps. Fergal pointed to the rudder of Marseille's plane.
"I have 12 kills, but this kid has 68,
he told Franz.
"Do you really believe that's possible?"
Franz counted the hash marks silently. Franz had once seen Marseille fighting, alone in the distance, while the rest of Marseille's squadron watched his aerial ballet. Franz believed. He also knew of Fergal's intense ambition. Despite being physically weak and the son of a postal worker, Fergal had somehow married the daughter of the German state secretary in Berlin. To Franz, Fergal always seemed to be trying to get somewhere. Rather than cross him, Franz said nothing.
I'm not trying to slander Marseille, Fergal said. What I'm saying is that in combat there's seldom time to watch an enemy crash. So there's room for doubt. Marseille gives himself the benefit of that doubt.
Slapping Marseille's rudder, Fergal skulked away into the darkness, back toward the squadron bar. 3 weeks later, May 31st, 1942. Franz settled his 109 down onto the hard desert floor and landed through the dust clouds stirred by Fergal's fighter ahead of him. The rising sun revealed their new home, a destitute, unfinished airstrip called Timimi that lay some 20 miles east of Martuba, close to the front lines. Rommel had summoned 2nd Group to Timimi. He was planning a big push, but first needed the Air Force's slow, antiquated Stuka dive bombers to soften up the enemy lines. To keep the Stukas from being blown out of the sky, he had called on JG-27. Franz and his comrades had lamented leaving Martuba's primitive comforts, but orders were orders, especially when issued by 2nd Group's new commander, Ruddle. Recently promoted, Ruddle now led the group's 3 squadrons, 4, 5, and 6. In leaving Squadron 4, Ruddle had given Fergal command due to Fergal's seniority, although Ruddle still had doubts about him. Grinning, Franz slid from the wing of his fighter. Fergal ran up and slapped his back. Fergal called the crew chiefs around and announced that Franz had scored his first victory. They had just flown a Stuka escort to a place called Fort Akroma, 17 miles behind enemy lines. There, with 7 109s, they had battled it out against 16 fighters of the Desert Air Force over a raging sandstorm. Just as Marseille and Char had advised him, Franz had waited until a P-40 was close, so close its tail was as tall as a sail in his gun sight when he blasted it from the sky. Franz and Fergal hurried to 2nd Group's headquarters to check in and debrief. They encountered Ruddle as he ducked out of the tent's canvas door. Ruddle asked how the mission went.
I got my first kill, sir,
Franz said. Ruddle's smile slowly disappeared. Franz wondered if he had said something wrong.
I got 2,
Fergal added. Ruddle seemed unimpressed. He asked if there were any losses.
3,
Fergal replied. Fluder, Krensky, and Gromotka. The missing pilots were from Squadron 6. Fluder had been the squadron leader and Ruddle's friend. Franz told Ruddle he had witnessed both Fluder's and Krenska's 109s exploding and was certain that both had been killed.
Then why are you both smiling?
Ruddle asked, his eyes emotional.
Because of his first kill, Fergal said.
Ruddle dropped his arms to his sides.
You score victories, not kills,
Ruddle told Fergal, frustrated.
Haven't you learned anything?
Turning to Franz, Ruddle added,
You shoot at a machine, not a man.
Fergal muttered something and looked toward the horizon. Ruddle looked like he was going to say something more, but he shook his head and walked away. Fergal muttered that Ruddle had it out for him. He stomped away. Franz knew Fergal was trying to save face. But Franz also knew that Ruddle had reason to dislike Fergal. The previous day, Fergal had landed and claimed to have shot down 3 fighters within 14 minutes, his 8th, 9th, and 10th victories all in one fight. Fergal's wingman and sidekick, a pilot named Sergeant Karl-Heinz Bendert, had confirmed Fergal's story as a witness. But others in Squadron 4 doubted Fergal's claims. Marseille could knock down 3 planes that quickly. But not Fergal, they whispered. Ruddle had no proof to overturn Fergal's claims, so he forwarded the victories to Berlin. Franz sulked back to his tent, alone. He had achieved a fighter pilot's milestone and tasted revenge. Instead of feeling accomplishment, he suddenly felt very hollow. 6. The Stars of Africa. 1 month later, June 25th, 1942, Egypt. Moonbeams illuminated a circle of tents on the north edge of the Sidi Barani airbase. Franz, Ruddle, and a handful of pilots sat within the tent's circle on thick stones around a campfire. They bantered while Franz ate tinned sardines. He had learned to tolerate anything edible. To the south of their campsite lay JG-27's temporary airstrip, Sidi Barani, its hard-packed runway glowing white in the moonlight. To the north, the sea sparkled near the coast, then faded to blackness in the distance. Behind the tents sat a small, crumbling desert fort. Normally campfires were forbidden, but Ruddle had approved the fire. He reasoned that if a British spotter plane saw the light, they would assume it was just a Bedouin campfire. There was nobody else for miles around anymore. Sidi Barani lay within Egypt, just 40 miles across the border from Libya. Just a few days earlier, the airfield had belonged to the British, evidenced by the empty cigarette packs they had left behind when they retreated. Rommel's push had broken through their lines. He had sacked Tobruk, the British battle capital in the western desert, and had driven the British out of Libya and back into Egypt. Now he was 90 miles to the east, chasing the British deeper and deeper into Egypt while aiming for the Suez Canal. That month, JG-27 had followed Rommel like a nomadic herd, flying from a new airfield nearly every week. The men flew with renewed vigor, believing the end of the desert war was just beyond the horizon. They also operated under a new, inspirational commander, Edu Neumann, who had been promoted to lead JG-27, all 9 squadrons. At night, the men slept under the stars. By day, the sight of the unit's fighters lined up on sandy runways reminded Franz of a holiday at the seashore. Between missions, mechanics propped small white umbrellas over the fighters' cockpits to keep the seats cool for the pilots. The pilots found time to sunbathe, and the ground crewmen worked on engines from the backs of trucks. Whenever Franz and the others saw the mechanics hurriedly collapsing the umbrellas, they knew it was time to go back to work. During one such mission, Franz lost his first airplane of the war. While attacking a desert fort, Franz's plane had been hit from ground fire. He had belly-landed within friendly lines and returned to his unit on a camel after a Bedouin tribesman rescued him. Franz's squadron mates had laughed when they saw him ambling the day after, still bow-legged from the bumpy camel ride. That night around the campfire, the sound of patrolling Ju-88 night fighters overhead promised Franz and his comrades that the skies were friendly. The sound reminded Franz of his brother, who had flown Ju-88s. Tears filled his eyes, but he brushed them away. A radio glowed on a crate behind the group. Cords led from the radio to a generator that hummed in the distant motor pool. The radio spouted music and military news. Other pilots wandered through. Among them were two of Ruddle's squadron commanders, Fergal and Lieutenant Rudy Zinner, who took seats around the fire. Zinner was short and unassuming, with a long nose that stood sharply from his calm eyes. He was an Austrian, like Fergal, and had begun his career in the Austrian army, tending horses that pulled cannons. Since those days, he referred to himself as just an ordinary soldier, even though he was a 7-victory ace. Ruddle had seen promise in Zinner, and had appointed him to lead Squadron 6, replacing the commander who had been killed on the day when Franz scored his first victory. With the radio chattering, a fire going, and tents to shield them from the desert wind, the men enjoyed a luxury they had lacked in weeks prior. They joked that for once they had it better than their British enemies, who they knew received regular rest and weekend leaves to metropolitan cities. They had heard captured British pilots tell them, "Should you chaps ever make it to Alexandria, the Cecil Hotel is your place, and if you find yourselves in Cairo, you must look up the Heliopolis Sports Club." "They are gentlemen," Zinner said. "You can't ask for a better enemy." The others agreed. Zinner related a story that Lieutenant Willy Kotman, a JG-27 ace, had told him. "Kotman warned me that you have to be careful with the captured Tommy pilot," Zinner said, "because he is always planning his escape back to his Pomeranian dog and gambling debts. He will not be comfortable as a prisoner until he is seen to both." Everyone laughed. Because the German pilots spoke English more readily than any other language, interactions between the two enemies were common. Once, when someone asked Marseille why he showed such interest in captured enemy pilots, he said, "I just like to talk to them."
"Where is Kottmann now?"
Franz asked. "He was killed last April," Zinner said sadly. Fergal scowled. He did not share the others' sporting respect for their enemies. He envied his enemies. They had more pilots and better planes now that their advanced Spitfire fighters were arriving. They did shorter tours and then rotated to England or Australia for quieter duty. Franz could tell that the hardened veterans around him could all use a break. Their clothes were sloppy, their faces gaunt, and their eyes weary. Ruddle told the others he was due for leave in a month, but was not looking forward to it. Everyone looked at him like he was crazy. At 9:50 p.m., someone tuned in Radio Belgrade, a station that beamed from the powerful German transmitter in Yugoslavia. Every night at the same time, the station played a recording of Lala Andersen, a German girl in her 30s, singing the song Lily Marlene. A German soldier named Hans Liep had originally written the song's lyrics as a poem during World War I. Thanks to Andersen's rendition, the song had become the German soldier's anthem. Like many other homesick warriors, the pilots of JG-27 tuned in nightly. So did their opponents. In Egypt, the British pilots were listening to the same radio show, in silence, in their mess tents. At 9:55 p.m., on cue, Andersen's hypnotically sensual and delicate voice floated from the radio speaker. She sounded gorgeous. Franz leaned closer, his ear glued to the radio. Andersen sang of a soldier who often met his girl under the lamppost outside of his camp before he was called away to war. "Time would come for roll call, time for us to part. Darling, I'd caress you and press you to my heart, and there, neath that far-off lantern light, I'd hold you tight. We'd kiss good night, my lily of the lamplight, my own Lily Marlene." As the song continued, Franz wondered to himself if Andersen were singing to the men on the steppes of Russia, or on the fields of Crete, or on the bluffs of France. Was anyone thinking of us in the desert? He wondered. "Resting in our billets, just behind the lines, even though we're parted, your lips are close to mine. You wait, where the lantern softly gleams, your sweet face seems to haunt my dreams, my lily of the lamplight, my own Lily Marlene." Beneath the stars, far from home, Franz, like his comrades and enemies across the desert, had tears in his eyes by the time the song trailed to silence. Franz would remember, "Half of us were crying. I can't describe it. We felt left out of everything." 1 month later, July 26, 1942, Kotayfiya, Egypt. Franz brought his 109 to a halt on the taxiway that paralleled the runway. Ahead, Ruddle powered up his plane in morning's yellow light. A vortex of sand blew from beneath the machine's belly. Ruddle's fighter's bare rudder flapped left and right, his pre-flight check. His rudder should have borne 45 victory marks, but still remained unmarked. Their mission that day was the same as many days prior. Stuka escort over the front lines that lay just a 10-minute flight away. A month earlier, JG-27 had come to Kotayfiya, a scorching, flat airfield halfway along the Egyptian coast. British bombers had hit the base only 2 days earlier. Craters now gave the field character, at least. Before, it had been a blank swath of white sand. Even with the ocean nearby, to the north, the heat hovered like a mirage. Rommel had ordered JG-27 to this awful place. He had pushed the British back, but not far enough to win the war in North Africa. When his advance had petered out, the Germans found themselves staring at the British from across trenches that ran from a coastal train station called El Alamein, deep into the desert. Rommel's great progress would be his undoing. He had stretched his forces far from their ports and supply lines, while pushing the British closer to theirs.
As British ships steamed into their port at Alexandria, carrying fresh pilots and planes to regenerate the Desert Air Force, the Germans flogged the same pilots and planes harder, sending them on Stuka escorts, often three times a day. The tiresome missions wore JG-27's pilots to the bone. The turning point in the Desert Air War had arrived. In the weeks prior, Franz and Ruddle had flown together almost daily. On one mission, Ruddle had downed three Spitfires, and Franz had bagged one, his third victory. Franz's fourth and fifth victories followed soon after, and he became classified as an ace. But Franz kept his rudder bare in an effort to emulate Ruddle, who had grown larger than life to him. Ruddle gave a fist-forward gesture to show Franz and the others in his flight that he was taking off, a silent signal in case the British were eavesdropping on the radio channel. He began his takeoff roll, his plane's prop blast showering white sand onto Franz's windscreen. Ruddle's fighter raced down the runway and shrunk in the distance. But either Ruddle in his fatigue or the crewman who had swept the runways after the bombing raid had failed to notice a piece of debris that lay in the path of Ruddle's fighter. Ruddle was at full takeoff speed when he hit the jagged debris. His plane veered off the runway and cartwheeled through the sand. Franz radioed the control bunker to send firefighters quickly. He and the others cut their engines and sprinted toward Ruddle. They never expected to see Ruddle emerge from the plane, but he did, and ran toward them, shouting, waving his arm and pointing east. When the men met Ruddle, his glare stopped them in their tracks. He clutched his ribs with one arm. His head was bleeding. "The Stukas!" he shouted at Franz and the others. "You don't stop for one man!" Franz's smile faded. The flight of Stukas was headed unescorted toward the British lines. It was too late to catch up. When medics arrived, they calmed Ruddle down, insisting he lie on a stretcher in the shade of their ambulance. Franz stood by as the medics loaded Ruddle into the truck.
"Damn it! Now I have to go home," Ruddle said with resignation before the medics slammed shut the doors.
Franz knew Ruddle did not want to go because he did not trust any other officer with the lives of his men. Before Ruddle departed, he appointed a temporary successor from his three squadron leaders based on the only standard he knew they would agree on. He picked the top ace, the man with the most victories. Fergal, with 20 victories, got the nod. Ruddle's gesture of impartiality would soon prove one of his biggest mistakes. As the blistering hot month of August arrived, life at Kotaifia reached a low point. The men lived like animals. They no longer slept in tents or under the stars. To avoid British strafing, Franz and the others slept in graves, 6 by 6 foot holes hacked into the earth, with a sheet of canvas overhead. Here, each man kept his cot, blanket, and belongings. The days of showering in fresh water were over. Everyone stank. When the men snuck away once a week to bathe in the ocean, they came back with their skin crusty with salt. Franz existed with the salt and sand caking his face, lining his hair, and sticking to the dried sweat on his back. The heat at Kotaifia was often 125 degrees Fahrenheit or hotter. Franz and his comrades developed chapped lips and sores that would not heal, sores the flies loved. Worse was whenever a flight taxied past and blew grains of sand into the men's bloodshot eyes and open cuts. On some days, sandstorms rolled in that settled over the airfield, choking Franz and his comrades with a white, hazy cloud. At night, Franz and the others drank to forget the day. Then they stumbled carefully through the graveyards, careful not to step on the poisonous asps and cobras that came out in darkness. After checking his grave for snakes, Franz said his prayers with his knees in the sand. Then he slid under his blankets and pulled them over his head, so spiders would not crawl across his face. At Kotaifia, Franz began dreaming of his mother's cooking, of eating his favorite dish, Leberkäse, a pan-fried Bavarian meatloaf made from finely chopped corned beef, pork, bacon, and onions. He imagined bowls of fresh vegetables, a taste he had long forgotten,
Red cabbage, spinach, potato salad, and potato pancakes appeared in his dreams. Then he would awake with his stomach cold and twisted, regretting that he had ever said, "I'll pass on anything that flies or swims." Within JG-27, it was common knowledge that a man could only endure 6 months of desert torture before his health fell to pieces. Life at Kotaifia accelerated that breaking point. Even the desert fox, Rommel, had to return to Germany after the desert knocked him out with a sinus infection. Franz knew Fergal and others had somehow withstood 8 months of the desert's torture, some 240 days worth. But he would soon discover that even the bravest of men could crack. There were few options to escape the desert's misery, among them death, wounds, insanity, and the passing of time. But one man had revealed the only other avenue of escape. Victories. Marseille's high scoring saw him flying home to Germany every 2 months to receive new decorations added to his knight's cross. First miniature oak leaves, and then miniature swords, each signifying higher degrees of the cross. Franz, Fergal, and their comrades all watched Marseille leave and wanted to go with him. At a time when desert life was grinding JG-27 to a halt, the competition for victories intensified. Due to wear and tear from the countless Stuka escorts, the squadrons that once had 16 fighters each now had, on average, just 4 planes operational. There were no longer enough planes to go around. When a perfectly good 109 arrived from Germany, the mechanics converged on it like cannibals and stripped its parts to keep several other planes flying. A new question arose in each squadron. Who gets to fly? As the leader of both 2nd Group and Squadron 4, Fergal made that call. Because Ruddle had crashed his fighter before Fergal could inherit it, Fergal had taken one of Squadron 4's planes for himself. That left 3 planes for him to pass around among the squadron's 16 pilots. He assigned another to his wingman and longtime sidekick, Sergeant Karl-Heinz Bendert. Bendert was a veteran too, and was known as the squadron's most ambitious pilot. He had a baby face with tiny, pouty lips, and was quick to snicker. Fergal gave Franz a plane because he considered him a friend. As if to spite the others, Fergal gave the squadron's 4th and last plane to a replacement pilot, the squadron's new arrival, Sergeant Erwin Schwalisch. Schwalisch was an old hare, seasoned in age and experience, with 18 victories to his name, most from the Eastern Front. Fergal took Bendart as his wingman and assigned Franz to Schwalisch, but warned Franz, "Schwalisch is an expert, but watch out. He is ill in the head." Fergal said this because Schwalisch had rotated home for instructor duty as a reward, but instead requested duty where the fighting was roughest, the desert. Without any say in the matter, Franz had become a member of Fergal's inner circle, a group his peers would call the Fergal Flight. Franz met Schwalisch when the ill pilot introduced himself at Franz's grave. Schwalisch had a strong face, a bulbous nose, thick cheeks, and a toothy smile. In talking, Franz discovered that Schwalisch was straight, or honest and professional. Schwalisch, too, had flown in the Spanish Civil War, but as a fighter pilot, and had scored 3 victories. The two bonded over memories of wine, tapas, and señoritas. Several days later, August 4th, 1942. At night, Schwalisch entered Franz's grave, obviously disturbed. In a hushed tone, Schwalisch said he had to tell Franz something in secret. Franz had not flown that day, due to maintenance on his fighter, but Schwalisch told him what he had missed. Schwalisch had flown twice that day, first at dawn when Bendert had summoned him to escort a reconnaissance plane with him. Together, they had attacked a dozen P-40s, and Schwalisch had knocked one from the sky. But on the way home, Bendert said he got one too, and told Schwalisch to confirm his victory, one Schwalisch never saw happen. That afternoon, Schwalisch flew with Bendert again. This time, Schwalisch shot down a Spitfire, and again Bendert claimed he had downed a Spitfire too, one that Schwalisch had not witnessed. Svalish was disturbed and asked Franz if loose scoring was the way of the desert. Franz said it happened. He had been there when everyone questioned Fergal's three claims in one mission, the victories that only Bendart would confirm. Franz and Svalish agreed they had no choice but to give Bendart the benefit of the doubt. In the week that followed, the Fergal flight flew and fought the group's only battles because Fergal ensured that they had the best missions and the planes to fly them. A pattern developed. Whenever the men landed and claimed victories, Bendart always claimed something. And if others claimed a victory, Bendart claimed the same or more. Then came August 10th, the day that broke the camel's back. That morning, Franz and Svalish scrambled to intercept British fighters that had been sighted over El Alamein. There, among the thick clouds that bordered the sea, Franz and Svalish attacked a pack of P-40s and Hurricanes. On their first dive, each claimed a P-40. On the second dive, Franz claimed a Hurricane. But as Franz pulled up to climb and repeat, he saw a terrifying sight behind his tail. Instead of the P-40s breaking into a defensive circle like they always had, they were chasing him. With Svalish flying ahead of him and unaware of the danger, Franz radioed him with alarm and told him to run. They were being chased. Svalish radioed back, "Nonsense." Franz saw the thick clouds along the sea and ran for them. But instead of fleeing with Franz, Svalish doubled back and flew toward him, flying over Franz's head. Seeing this, Franz thought, Fergal was right. He is ill in the head. Franz steered for the safety of the clouds, but kept checking his tail. There, he saw an incredible sight. In a tan streak, he watched Svalish fly head-on into the formation of P-40s, his guns firing. The P-40s peeled in all directions. Svalish plowed through the melee and somehow emerged on the other side. Franz saw black smoke and knew that someone had been hit. He cursed Svalish for not escaping with him. Franz blew out a heavy sigh as the cloud's floating tentacles wrapped around his canopy, enshrouding him in mist, turning the daylight into dimness. Banking westward, he wove through the heavenly white river, following his compass until he popped into the blue, alone, above his desert home. After landing, Franz found Svalish circling his parked fighter, checking it for damage. Relieved, Franz shouted, "You never go tooth to tooth with a Curtis!"
"In the east, we don't run from Ivan," Svalish chuckled. "Why start now?"
Franz realized the ill pilot's antics were actually his odd brand of bravery. Franz reached out his hand, and Svalish shook it, flashing a big, toothy grin. Around noon that same day, Fergal and Bendart returned from their flight and found Franz and Svalish in their mess tent. Franz told Fergal that he and Svalish had each bagged two planes. Fergal and Bendart said that they, too, had each knocked down two planes. Desert Air Force Squadron diaries would later reveal that Fergal and Bendart had shot down none of the fighters that they claimed that day. South African Air Force Squadron 2 would report, "Dogfight with two 109s, no results." And Royal Air Force Squadron 80 would report, "On two occasions, two ME-109Fs were seen. These made dive attacks, but they were ineffective." Franz and Svalish gritted their teeth. When Fergal and Bendart had departed, Svalish and Franz agreed that their group leader and his wingman were up to no good. In the evening of August 14th, Fergal delivered a message from JG-27's commander, Neumann, to Franz and Svalish. Neumann had ordered the Fergal flight to assemble on the flight line the next morning. Franz immediately thought that someone was in trouble. When Franz and Svalish plodded to the flight line the next day, as ordered, Svalish was sullen. He was certain that Fergal and Bendart were going to drag him and Franz down with them. But when they reached the flight line, they found Neumann and his staff waiting with photographers. Neumann congratulated the men and said he wanted to celebrate their recent successes. In the weeks prior, the Fergal flight had kept Neumann's orderly busily painting palm fronds on their girls. In 15 days, they had scored a squadron's worth of victories. Franz had chalked up 9 victories, upping his total to 14. Svalish had added 15 victories, doubling his score to 30. Fergal posted 6 victories and now had 26 overall. Bendart added 16, bringing his total to 34, elevating him among the ranks of Marseille and Ruddle as one of JG27's top 10 scorers. With Marseille on leave, the Fergal flight had become the new Stars of Africa. Fergal arrived wearing a white officer's hat like Ruddle's, and black sun goggles atop its brim. Despite the heat, Bendart wore a fancy green jacket. Franz and Svalish just wore their everyday attire. The photographers steered the group to Svalish's plane because Svalish had unique victory marks. His rudder bore 30 hash marks, and the black silhouettes of 2 ships that he had sunk on the Eastern Front. Fergal joked to Franz that no one would want to be seen by his naked rudder, and ordered Franz to paint it up. Franz nodded with reluctance, while wondering what Ruddle would think. The photographers arranged the men in a lineup along the plane's rear fuselage. But Svalish let his arms hang, looking dejected.
"Laugh," a photographer urged. "Tell a joke," the other said.
Franz said something to Svalish to make him laugh as the shutter snapped. When Neumann shook each pilot's hand, Franz and Svalish knew this was their chance to reveal their suspicions of Fergal and Bendart, but they said nothing. They knew it was too late, and they were already guilty by association. As other pilots walked past the photo shoot, their glares did all the talking. That night, while Neumann's orderly painted palm fronds, in the squadron bars around the airfield, the unit's pilots debated the Fergal flight's meteoric rise. Among the squadrons of First Group, Marseille's group, some pilots gave the Fergal flight a mocking new name, the Expert Flight. They, too, knew that victories were the key to the Knight's Cross, fan mail, and a ticket home. At the time, Germany had no bigger heroes than her fighter pilots, and even the heroes had a hierarchy according to their scores. The First Group pilots saw the Fergal flight's soaring claims as Fergal's underhanded attempt for his group to compete against theirs. Had Marseille been there, he might have told his comrades otherwise, for he was the master at scoring multiple victories day after day. But he was on leave in Germany. In his absence, a few First Group pilots decided the Expert Flight was cheating and had to be stopped. One day later, August 16, 1942, over El Alamein. When the Fergal flight plunged into combat in the early morning of August 16th, they did so to answer another flight's cries for help. 2 planes from First Group had radioed in distress. The leader of Squadron 2, Lieutenant Hans Arnold Stahlschmidt, a 21-year-old ace with 45 victories, and his wingman were badly outnumbered in a dogfight against as many as 38 enemy fighters. Although Stahlschmidt was a rival, the Fergal flight scrambled to his aid with a 5th plane in their formation instead of the usual 4. That day, Fergal had invited along a rookie, Corporal Ferdinand Just, who had recently arrived with a plane of his own. Fergal was good to the new guys because they were black sheep like him. After 15 minutes of fighting, the Fergal flight and its rookie turned for home, victorious. They had saved Stahlschmidt and his wingman, while claiming a combined 11 victories. Even the rookie, Just, had scored his first victory. But it was not what they would claim that would seal the Fergal flight's fate. It was what they did next. At 3,000 feet over friendly lines, Fergal radioed Just and asked for his ammo status. Just replied that he was about full. Fergal decided to give the rookie some target practice by playing a game called Shoot the Shadow. Franz appreciated Fergal's concern for the new guy, but he knew the skies were unsafe, and asked Fergal if this was wise. Fergal dismissed Franz and told him, "Stiegler, you can play the shadow." Franz hated being ordered to play a game when he should be watching for enemy fighters. Svalish promised he would keep an eye out. Franz flew ahead and positioned his plane so its shadow flew in front of him on the sands. Fergal ordered Just to get on his wing as he dropped down to 1,000 feet.
"See the shadow?" Fergal asked Just. "Kill it."
But the young pilot did not understand.
"Strafe the shadow on the sand," Fergal clarified.
Franz flew straight and level to keep his shadow flat. He heard Yust's gunfire crackle beneath him, then saw geysers of sand rip through his shadow before Yust's 109 peeled off to reform with Fergal.
Franz flew onward, sweating out the silly game. Fergal ordered Franz to make things challenging.
Franz rolled his eyes. He began snaking right and left using just his rudder, so his shadow stayed flat as it made lazy S-patterns.
Fergal ordered Bendart and Svalish to attack the shadow as examples to Yust.
Both veterans wove along with Franz, mirroring his moves. When they passed beneath Franz, they cut loose with what ammo they had remaining. Each veteran's bullets perfectly tracked the shadow, tossing sand and obliterating rocks. The Fergal flight was having so much fun in their mock dogfight that they failed to see two black specks paralleling them in the distance by the ocean. The Fergal flight landed, claimed their victories, and headed to the squadron tent to celebrate their most momentous day yet. But their rival, Stahlschmidt, had already landed. He and his wingman had marched straight for Neumann's headquarters, now an above-ground bunker after his circus wagon had been destroyed. The next day, a rumor ran rampant throughout the pilot camps. The Fergal flight was going to be stripped of their victories. Franz and Svalish could not believe it. They asked around and learned that Stahlschmidt had reported seeing the Fergal flight in mock dogfights, emptying their guns into the sand. Stahlschmidt believed that this was the secret behind the Fergal flight's victories. They would pretend to fight and come home with their ammo exhausted to lie about what they had done. A day later, Fergal spotted his squadron leaders entering Neumann's headquarters. When Fergal asked why he had not been invited, Neumann's orderly told him, "It's a private matter." Svalish took the news hard and grew melancholy.
"It's an omen," he told Franz.
A fighter pilot since 1936, his victories were his resume and his life. He was a professional flyer. The hash marks were all he had to show for his 6 years of dueling with death. Now he had heard that the pilots of the Fergal flight would be stripped of all their victories. It was no longer their 2 weeks of combat being questioned, but each man's honor. A day later, August 19, 1942. At dawn, Neumann's orderly delivered messages to Franz, Svalish, Fergal, and Bendart, summoning them to report to Neumann's headquarters that afternoon. Svalish ran to Franz's dugout, distraught. He was certain that Fergal and Bendart had destroyed them.
"We're to be court-martialed," he said.
Franz's stomach sank. Fergal and Bendart were dressed in flight gear when they found Franz and Svalish moping. Fergal said they were answering a scramble mission and wanted Franz and Svalish to come. Bendart was glib as usual. Franz admitted he was not in the mood to fly, and Svalish agreed. Fergal knew what was eating them, and reassured Franz and Svalish that Neumann would see that Stahlschmidt was wrong when they presented their side of the story. Fergal and Bendart departed to fly. Franz did not fear a court-martial. He feared a court-martial going wrong, and them taking the blame for any loose claims since JG-27 had arrived in the desert. After the midday meal, Franz felt overwhelmed by worry. He lay on his cot in his grave and stared through cracks of light in the canvas ceiling. Around 1 o'clock p.m., he heard noise above and saw Svalish peel back the canvas. Svalish said he was taking a plane up for a maintenance test flight before the meeting with Neumann. Franz thought nothing of it. Many times he had gone flying to clear his head. Before leaving, Svalish told Franz that regardless of the meeting's result, he would always think of him as the best of comrades. Franz knew Svalish was scared because he had no clout with JG-27 and no relationship with the powers that would be judging him. Franz promised Svalish that he would ensure their names were cleared. Svalish smiled and departed, the canvas flap swinging behind him. Franz fell asleep. An hour later, he opened his eyes with distress when the realization hit him. Why would a 33 victory ace undertake a maintenance flight? That's a rookie's job.
Franz's heart screamed with alarm. But he was an hour too late. Svalish never came back from his maintenance flight. Neumann canceled the meeting. The next day, on the shores north of Kortaifia, German sentries found Svalish's body, carried to land by the tide. Some said his plane had malfunctioned, but Franz knew otherwise. Svalish had wanted to disappear. That's why he had flown out over the sea. There he had committed suicide, diving into the water, rather than live to see his victories and honor wrongly stripped from him. On the day Svalish died, Fergal and Bendart landed from their scramble. Fergal claimed one victory, and Bendart another two. 11 days later, August 30th, 1942. A month after his crash, Ruddle returned to the unit. Franz found him moving his belongings into his hole in the earth. Ruddle had resumed control of second group, sending Fergal back to Squadron 4. Ruddle told Franz he had spent only a week at home in Merseburg, and the rest of the time traveling there and back. "I prefer it here," Ruddle admitted, a comment that Franz found odd. Franz tried to explain what had happened with the Fergal flight, but Ruddle cut him off. He had already talked with Neumann, who told him the matter was closed. All the victories in question had been confirmed and sent to Berlin. Franz looked at Ruddle with disbelief. Ruddle explained that Neumann decided not to pass judgment because he had not been there, flying with them in life-and-death combat. Neumann had decided to give his men the benefit of the doubt. Franz told Ruddle that there had been a breach of honor. Ruddle asked Franz if it was worth reopening a closed case. Ruddle explained that during the month in question, Bendart had scored his 30th victory, Magic 30, and had been nominated for the Knight's Cross. But Franz told Ruddle he had promised Svalish he would see their names cleared, and there would always be doubt unless the truth was told. Ruddle agreed to look into the matter, but knew it would get ugly.
"You could have saved us a lot of trouble if you had just taken a stand," he told Franz, who nodded in silent agreement. "I'm afraid you won't be here to see the results," Ruddle said.
Franz did not understand.
"You're going home," Ruddle said. "It didn't do me any good, but you might enjoy it."
For a moment, Franz reacted like Ruddle had after his crash. There was something about the simplicity of the desert life, even its hardships, that made him not want to leave. During the first week of September 1942, Franz found himself sitting on a lonely bench at the far end of the airfield, where Ju-52 transports delivered the unit's supplies. Franz had his orders: hitch a ride on a transport to Libya, then fly to Sicily, then Italy. From there, he would take a train to Germany. Every so often an old sergeant emerged to tell Franz that a Ju-52 was due any minute. The windsock hung limp. There were no eager rookies checking in for a great adventure, just mechanics linking ammunition belts, while orderlies inventoried supplies. Franz had said goodbye to Ruddle, his comrades, and even Marseille, who had just returned from leave. Franz had found Marseille lounging around, strangely reluctant to return to the cockpit. Marseille no longer displayed photos of actresses and models in his dugout, and had replaced them with just one framed picture of his girlfriend, Anneliese, a schoolteacher.
"We just got engaged," Marseille told him. "On my next leave, hopefully at Christmas time, we'll be married. If not, I'm waiting until next Christmas. It's the best time for a wedding."
When Franz suggested that Marseille would never be as much fun, the Star of Africa proved otherwise and recited the latest dirty jokes he had learned. Marseille recommended restaurants Franz could visit in Berlin.
"Tell them you're my friend," he told Franz, "and they'll throw you out before they'll seat you."
From his airline days, Franz knew the sound of a Ju-52 by heart. In the distance, the plane landed through a wave of heat. High above, its 109 escorts circled the transport, their duty not completed until the plane had unloaded, reloaded, and was flying back the way it had come. The Ju-52 taxied to a stop, but kept its engines running as crewmen erected a ramp up to the plane's side fuselage. They wheeled barrels from the plane's belly. Franz shouldered his bag as a Kubelwagen screeched to a stop behind him. Ruddle climbed out.
"I always see my pilots off," Ruddle reminded Franz. "I'm just glad we're not talking through a slab of wood."
Franz tucked his hat into his sweaty armpit. Dropping his sea bag, he went to salute Ruddle, who instead stuck out his hand, just like when they had first met. They shook hands, both serious. They knew there was no guarantee that Franz's plane would make it across the Mediterranean, and Ruddle had just checked himself back into hell. The Ju-52's loadmaster grabbed Franz's shoulder and pointed toward the waiting plane. The plane's pilots stared through their windows at Franz, annoyed, eager to get as far from the front as possible. Franz entered the plane and sat uncomfortably in the back, not used to riding. The plane carried him away. The next day, he would leave the dark continent on a Ju-52 loaded with wounded, groaning Afrika Korps soldiers. As the plane passed over the African coast, this time, Franz did not look out the window. 7. The Homecoming. A week later, early September 1942, near Amberg, Franz approached the door to the pub. He smoothed his grayish-blue blazer and pulled its yellow collar tabs. His crush cap sat straight on his head, so he cocked it at a jaunty angle like the other veterans did. A tan cloth band encircled the left cuff of his blazer and read Afrika, a badge that only men who had fought there could wear. He cinched his black tie. The tie was not just for special occasions. The Air Force fashioned itself as Germany's most gentlemanly military branch. Everywhere but in the desert, German pilots wore ties, even when flying. Inside the pub, Franz strolled up to the brewmaster's daughter, the girl of his teenage dreams, whose blonde hair and busty influence had helped steer him away from the priesthood. Franz beamed a wide smile and removed his hat, revealing his hair neatly slicked back, with the sides and back cropped short. The girl emerged from behind the bar, looked him over, and stopped an awkward foot away from him. Franz gazed at her. She slapped him hard on the cheek. Smarting, Franz looked at her wide-eyed.
"Aren't you ashamed to be here?"
the girl snapped.
"What's wrong?"
Franz asked, his eyes wide with surprise.
"Get out! Get out! Get out!"
she screamed. Franz hesitated and asked again what he had done wrong. The girl threatened to call her father. Franz ran for the door. That night, Franz sat with his mother as she sipped a beer. Every night, without fail, she always drank a beer. Franz confessed his woes with the brewmaster's daughter. His mother shrugged with a guilty grin. Franz realized she was somehow behind the slap he had received. He asked his mother what she had done. His mother admitted that when Franz had departed for Africa, he had left so many girlfriends behind that each wrote to her, seeking for news of him. She did not reply. So the girls wrote again and again. Then they started coming to her door to ask about Franz. Annoyed, Franz's mother wrote a letter to each girl that said, "Franz is married. Leave him alone." Franz broke out laughing at his stern old mother. He knew she probably still prayed he would come to his senses and become a priest. Franz's holiday was supposed to last 8 weeks, but he found himself wanting to return to the desert sooner. When he biked around Amberg, his friend's parents told him where their boys had been deployed. Every morning, when he rustled open his newspaper, the headlines revealed bad news from the African front. JG-27 lost 40 victory ace Sergeant Gunter Steinhausen, and a day later, 59 victory ace Stahlschmidt, both killed. 3 weeks later, the headlines screamed in big black letters that Squadron 3's hero of the desert, Marseille, was dead. Franz read the story in shock. It said that Marseille had died bailing out of his fighter after a combat mission. But Franz knew there had to be more to the story that no one was saying, The Desert Air Force could never kill Marseille. As his leave wound down in October, Franz's orders changed. He was told not to return to his unit because JG-27 was withdrawing from the desert. Africa had become a lost cause for the Germans. The British had launched an attack from El Alamein, a push that Rommel was unable to stop. In early November, as the Germans retreated, a new foe landed behind them in Casablanca, the Americans. When the first American flyer was captured, Neumann invited the pilot to join him for breakfast. Neumann was amazed that the American, a major, wore only a one-piece olive-green flight suit. Neumann looked upon the enemy flyer with great worry as the American happily ate his breakfast. He knew that behind that one man stood the might of the American industrial empire. Neumann lost his appetite. Around the table with his father and Father Joseph, Franz came to the same conclusion, and worse. They agreed that the war had already been decided, ever since June 1941, when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union and opened a two-front war. Hitler had told his people that Stalin was about to attack them, but the truth did not matter. The older man had already lost a war in 1918 and knew how a nation's doom played out. They knew at that moment, in November 1942, that Germany was going to lose the Second World War.
"What do I do now?"
Franz asked his elders.
"You're a German fighter pilot,"
Franz's father said.
"That's all there is to it."
Father Joseph nodded, having been a fighter pilot himself. Although he never spoke of his war stories, he told Franz something he would never forget.
"Don't worry," he said. "We fight our best when we're losing."
8. Welcome to Olympus. 6 months later, April 13, 1943, Northwest Sicily. Hidden in the shade of an olive tree, the white nose cone of the gray BF-109 began to spin, its black blades catching the midday sunlight that snuck through the branches. The engine whined, coughed, and belched white smoke before settling into a powerful rhythm. Franz sat in the cockpit, a pipe clenched in his teeth. He wore just his tent cap, no flight helmet, no ear protection, and worked the throttle of the new 109. Mechanics in oil-stained t-shirts and baggy khakis watched from the side of the spinning prop. Sicily was as hot as the desert, but unlike Africa, Sicily had trees, flowers, and streams around which high scrub bushes grew. At Trapani Airfield, the Squadron 6 mechanics preferred to work in the shade at the south corner of the base, far from the big target hangars on the north end. The lead mechanic leaned into the cockpit and studied the gauges.
"She's still running hot,"
Franz insisted to the mechanic, who listened in to hear Franz's words. Yellow 2 was a new Gustav, or G4, model, fresh from the factory. With its new camouflage scheme, the fighter looked like a sleek gray shark as it vibrated in the olive grove. The plane's flanks and wings were gray, its belly was white, and along the fighter's spine ran a wavy swath of molted black. A yellow 2 stood starkly from its camouflage. Franz shut down the plane and hopped out. The mechanic insisted that Franz must be imagining problems. Franz reminded the mechanic that a G model had killed Marseille. Franz had learned the story of Marseille's death when he reunited with the unit. When JG-27 had been issued the new G models, Marseille had refused to fly his and had barred his pilots from doing so because the plane's new, more powerful Daimler-Benz engine was prone to failure. After General Albert Kesselring heard that Marseille was casting doubt on the G, he ordered Marseille to fly the new plane anyway. That's how Marseille died. He had been flying home from a mission when a gear in his G model's engine shattered and broke the oil line. Smoke billowed into his cockpit, blinding and disorienting him. Marseille failed to notice that his plane had slipped into a dive. When he jumped, instead of falling beneath the plane, the airflow sucked his body into the plane's rudder. The same rudder that had borne his 158 victory marks had smashed Marseille's chest, rendering him unconscious and unable to deploy his chute. Marseille's friends had watched helplessly as he fell to earth. His comrades later returned to the airfield in a Kubelwagen with Marseille's body resting across their laps. In a palm grove, they displayed his casket in the bed of a truck. After burying Marseille, they gathered in a tent and listened to his favorite song, Rumba Azul, on his gramophone. A month later, they had to be removed from combat due to shattered morale. The mechanic promised Franz he would take a look. His men reached for their tools, propped up the engine cowlings with rods, and began ratcheting off the engine cover. Franz departed, darting across the runway with his life preserver in one hand and his flight helmet in the other. Small silver flare cartridges lined the tops of his boots like bullets. The flares were a necessity now that he regularly flew over water. Across the runway to the north lay the small village of Milo, with its flat white roofs. Beyond it stood the massive, dusty-looking Mount Erice, which looked like it belonged in the American Badlands. Ruddle kept his headquarters there, in a cave just below the summit. Atop Erice, an ancient, abandoned Norman castle clung to the mountain's eastern lip. Called Venus Castle, the towers and walls had been built over an ancient temple to the Roman goddess Venus. Franz often envisioned ghostly knights staring down on the airfield from the ramparts. A month earlier, the group had deployed to Trapani Airfield from Germany. Ruddle had promoted Franz to staff sergeant and placed him in Squadron 6 under Rudi Zinner, thinking the humble pilot a better influence than Fergal, whom Ruddle had dispatched to lead a detachment in Africa. Franz ambled along the flight line where the new 109s of Squadron 6 sat in gray brick blast pens held together by white mortar,